Hey everyone, this is Meredith Carey, and you are listening to Women Who Travel, a podcast from Condé Nast Traveler. As always, I am joined by my co-host, Sally Arakoglu.
Hello.
I actually said your name out loud this time. Today, we are joined by two of our dearly beloved friends over at Bon Appetit. You have heard from one of them before, my fellow Dallas girl, Priya Krishna, who called in from a parking garage last time.
Parking garage in Long Island City.
Perfect.
We thought you were joking until you like FaceTimed in and it really was a parking lot.
She is the author of Indianish, which will hit bookstores in April, and Carla Music, Bon Appetit's food director, whose cookbook Where Cooking Begins is out this March. Carla, thank you for joining
us. My pleasure.
If you haven't guessed, based on the fact that both of them have upcoming cookbooks, and by the plugs that I just gave them, we are talking today about travel through the lens of cooking. And so as a reformed picky eater, I have a question for you both, which is what trip, like iconic trip, made you fall in love with a brand new food?
So 10 years ago, my husband and I were invited to a wedding in India, which I had dreamed of, like getting to go to an Indian wedding. And then it really happened. And we turned the event of the wedding into like a 2-week trip. We went to Mumbai and we went to Delhi and we went to lots of spots in between. And that is where I first had idli. Priya will know what these are, which are little steamed.
One of my favorite foods of all time.
I had never had them. They're little steamed like rice and dal and fenugreek, I think. Little tiny steamed round pancakes that were on a lot of the breakfast buffets, and always with like a spicy coconut chutney or some other kind of hot, you know, condiment, spicy condiment. And so I fell in love with the pancakes, but also just with the idea of savory breakfast. Mm-hmm. And then came home and was like, we have to make idli, and like looked them up and tried to figure it out. And went to Kalustian's and was like, well, I don't have the right pan to make the perfect little, they're like little UFO shaped,
yep,
kind
that's
of.
That's exactly.
And I was like, that's fine. I'll just figure. And they, you know, I could never replicate it, but still I think that savory breakfast was something that stayed with us after that.
Wait, Carla, can I tell you something? When I was in Delhi last, I found this contraption in a grocery store. It was like a beat up box, and it said it was an idli maker that could also make like pizza and cake. And I asked the lady in Hindi, and of course, like, she was just like, yes, I can make anything you want. And so
amazing.
I bought it. It was 50 rupees, like, which is $2 basically. And it has been the most life-changing.
No like, way.
For most Indians, like the idea of making idli, like that's a weekend project.
Right.
Like
the you don't. The recipes are just,
yeah,
like,
it's
soak
insane.
The rice, drain the rice, pulverize, yeah, the rice, ferment the rice. It's like, I think you want to breakfast today.
However, this idli maker allows you to make 1-minute microwave idlis that taste as fluffy as my mom's. And
wow.
I literally like had my parents over to my apartment in New York because they did not believe me. I made them idlis and I made sambar in my Instant Pot. I made a little chutney. And they were like, this is a magic device.
The magic idli
and
box.
So like when I'm working from home, it's the ultimate luxury to make
God.
Idlis for lunch. It's
do
the greatest you, thing.
Do you buy the like idli mix?
Yeah, but you have to know there's like
there's
good
the
brands
right
and bad,
yeah,
brands. And then I mix, so most people do water. I mix like a little bit of watery yogurt into it, which gives a little bit more bounce. And so you kind of figure out your way to like doctor up the mix and make it taste a little bit more homemade. But like no one I know is like fermenting the bad. Like
right,
that's not a thing that people, I mean, people that I know do, but
yeah,
I'll make you idli sometime.
Okay. Yeah,
I was about to say meet up at Priya's, yeah, apartment.
This is cannot come
over. Exactly.
Did your parents go out and try and find this contraption?
No, it was just in this random department store in India, so I don't know if it's available in the States.
Have you made any of the other things that
the
it
pizzas,
claims
cakes,
to
and pies?
Yeah.
Well, I mentioned this to an editor once, and she was like, can you try to make just like crazy flavors of idlis,
yeah,
in that? So I tried making a pumpkin spice idli. And
it
turned out it's terrible. Like, you definitely should not be making.
It reminds me of those, yeah, little hand pie makers. They're kind of like waffle,
yes,
irons,
yes,
but you like put the dough in and then the filling and it like seals it. Yeah.
And Priya, what about?
Yeah.
I'm assuming it wasn't just that.
No, I knew about idlis all along. My big experience was when my family got to go to Egypt, and that was the first time I'd had fresh pita straight out of the oven with hummus. And I just remember so distinctly being in Cairo, being at this restaurant and this woman pulling pita out of the bread oven. And it was just sort of like steamy and delicious. And I'd only had roti, which is like a little bit more of a flat thing. Like sort of pita's got a little bit more of a three-dimensional aspect to it. It's sort of a little bit charred and burnt. So it was sort of familiar but different. And then they gave us the hummus, which they drizzled with oil and put this like Kashmiri red chili powder on. And I just remember eating that, like swiping that pita through that hummus and thinking it was like the greatest thing ever. And now, obviously, this is before the days of Sabra and dessert hummus. And I just thought that hummus was the greatest thing I'd ever tasted. And with that pita, it was just totally mind-blowing.
It's funny. One of my earliest food memories is being on holiday with my family in Turkey and being at this house where they had this like wood oven built outside in this back garden, and there was this old woman like making pita bread and cooking it in there, and she like gave me some, and it was just like burnt my hands because it was so freshly out of there, and that smell, and it's so pillowy and soft when you bite into it. Back to England and all the pita was shit.
Well, and you were talking about coming home and just trying your best to recreate something. Again, reformed picky eater, horrible home cook. Do you guys just come back and think, okay, I have to recreate all of these amazing things that I ate on my last trip?
Well, I don't, but my mother does. I'm like very reliant on my mom to do that. And she is the queen of recreating. Like we went to Tuscany and we ate Ribollita for the first time. And it was one of those moments where I was like, this is incredible. And so my mom came home and she made Ribollita, but my mom's big thing, and this is sort of a premise of the book, is like adding these Indian flourishes. So her Ribollita had double the vegetables, plus some ginger, plus chopped green chilies in it, which of course I'm sure any Tuscan person would be like completely horrified by, but this is how my mother wanted to adapt it to her tastes. The same thing happened. We went to Vermont and had, this is like one of my earliest food memories. I was like 5 or 6 years old. We had these puff pastries that were filled with like mushrooms cooked in sherry and cream. And it was like to this day, I think is one of the greatest things I've ever eaten. This restaurant doesn't exist anymore. And my mom like had never had puff pastry before. So she literally like studied puff pastry for weeks and recreated this thing for me. And it was sort of like how she showed love was like, we went on these trips, we had these dishes that we loved, and she would come home and spend weeks trying to recreate it. And I mean, those are just some of my best food memories from growing up.
Yeah, I basically am the complete opposite. Usually, and I don't know why. I think like being on vacation and eating something on vacation like stays in the vacation and nothing tastes the same, you know? Like you could drink a Coke in, you know, on the beach in the French Riviera and you're like, this tastes totally different than Coke anywhere else, you know? And you just can't like recreate that. So usually for me, it'll come up way later. And especially working at Bon Appetit, you have this ability to hang on to food ideas or recipes. Like it'll percolate. Like, you know, everything that's happening is maybe you're in the moment, but like maybe it's for something. So a lot of times it'll come up way later. Like, oh, well, actually when I was in Rome, I had this insane dish of pasta that like now we're going to do a page in one travel issue, and it's like wanting an iconic dish, and then it'll come up and then you get to go back and recreate it. But usually when I get home, I want home cooked food, and usually I the first thing I'll make is like pasta aglio olio and just have like a dish of pasta when I get back.
Yeah, because I'm curious, because we actually like polled our editors last year and asked what everyone's like go-to stop on the way home to get food was when they like land back in the U.S. And I have a very distinct Texas. I stop at Torchy's.
Oh
no, I wish. I don't have the time to sit. Love Miko. I don't have the time to sit and wait for them to bring out.
You can call while you're at the airport, and they will have it ready for you. I've done this many times.
You're changing my life. and I also like at that point would want a mambo taxi, which is like half sangria, half margarita. Yeah. There are things that I would want to commit to if I went to Miko. But I go to Torchy's Tacos and get the same order every time. I get 2 green chili pork and 1 trailer park with queso on it.
I can confirm, having been taken 2 Torchy's by Meredith. It's quite a place.
But do you have somewhere that you go either when you come back to New York or when you go back to Texas that is like your go-to on your way home from a trip?
When I come back to New York, all I want to do is make dal chawal. So that's what I make immediately. I like cook some rice and then put dal in the Instant Pot. That is like my, I don't want to go out to eat. I just want to eat dal chawal.
Same.
But if I'm home, I guess it's either dal chawal, but if I'm home in Texas, Mi Cocina is the alternative. Mi Cocina is this Tex-Mex chain that I've written about in Bon Appetit that just is so nostalgic for all Texans who grew up in the 90s.
Yeah, it's not even the best Tex-Mex restaurant, but it is like the best
like
in
the
our
most
hearts.
Beloved. Yeah.
Do you have a place when you go back to London, Lolly?
I thought you were going to ask New York, and I was like, that drive from JFK to anywhere in the country.
Where did you stop?
It is disheartening, yeah.
I'm just like, get me back on the plane. And I regret all my decisions about moving here. In London, I always want to go to my favorite pub, which is around the corner from my parents' house, called The Cow. And they have this crab pasta, which is just like rich and tomatoey and spicy and crabby and delicious, and I love it, and I get it every time. And then I'll also get a side of a half pint of prawns, and they're like the peel and eat prawns, and they're a little mayo thing that you dip in them, which is a very English thing that you can get in pubs, and I really think it should spread elsewhere.
It's not a bar snack here.
Yeah, it's just a pint glass stuffed with shrimp.
Amazing.
It's great. Add it to your dinner parties. And that's always what I want to do. My mum always just, that's where we go as soon as I get back. So I'll be doing that next weekend when I go home.
Gosh.
Carla, what about you?
When I get home, yeah, I don't want to go out to eat anywhere. I just miss home and kind of want to be home. And I think also it's like, it's not like pulling off what
in
sounds
New York,
like
it's harder. Yeah,
yeah, like a freeway experience.
Where you're
just like, I'm like imagining just like the when you're coming over the BQE and it's just like, why do we live here? You know, and then you just need like the but it sounds like that's what you make too. You make this comfort food. Yeah,
definitely.
Carla, you kind of touched on this a little bit. When you're sort of yearning to go back to a place that you've traveled to and visited or somewhere you love, is there a dish that you cook that sort of at least can sort of send you back there a little bit?
So in my cookbook, there's a few recipes that have been inspired. It's just funny because it's not like any kind of a glamorous faraway travel. But for a bunch of years in a row, we rented this little house in Montauk on Long Island. My family, I have two sons, my husband, and we would always go the end of July, early August. And it's just like the best produce time of year and the ocean and just every day kind of being able to cook from things were incredibly fresh. And actually the way that I shop and cook when we were out there on these just family vacations was very much the inspiration for my book, sort of learning that like that was the way that all the best food that I make sort of happens, you know, without a plan, but knowing that there's just great stuff in the market. And so a lot of times I would shop for produce without having a plan of what I was going to make for dinner, and then picking up, going either to Gossman's for seafood or like into another place in town to get meat, and really just buying what looked good and not thinking about it much further than that, and then cooking meals that were just so satisfying because they were improvisational, but everything that we bought was so incredible. So in the book I have, there's a pasta with a burst tomato sauce and lobster, which somehow when you're on vacation, the idea of like just buying two lobsters to split among four people, it seems like normal. and with just fresh tomato and garlic and basil. And there was another dish. Another one of my favorites is, it's a really tiny house with a tiny little kitchen, but there's a gas-fired grill outside. So what I'll do is take a cast iron skillet and put it on that grill grate, because it's actually electric grills gas grills are great for like, they're really even. You just turn them on. You don't have to wait. And so I'll do steamed clams and ginger and garlic and like olive oil and butter in the cast iron pan outside. So like just that sensation of kind of the sun going down and you're still in your kind of wet bikini and maybe you already had a glass of wine and cooking on the deck. So that place, like, And that style of cooking really inspires me a lot. I have a lot of just love for those summers, like taught me. Also, it was a really tiny refrigerator. So it taught me to like just buy for today and tomorrow. So like whatever we ate for dinner would spill over into breakfast and lunch, and then we would just repeat it. I know it's a fantasy, but sometimes like getting yourself back to like that ideal is a good inspiration.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite dish to remind you of a trip you've taken before?
I mean, those idlis remind me of like being back and being back in Delhi and that being a thing that you can just eat every single day. I would say like my fondest eating memories are often have to do with being in Delhi, where my family is from, and being at my great aunt's house, and whatever she cooks me is just like the best thing I could possibly be eating at this moment. Like she makes this amazing scramble, which there's an adapted version in my cookbook where she's crumbles up paneer and scrambles it with a bunch of turmeric and lime and ginger and cumin, and then these like really thinly sliced green beans, and then she serves it over breakfast, and then she puts bhujia, which are sort of these crispy like sprinkle like savory potato crisps that you put over it. Like I love eating that. Usually I'm like, I play fast and loose with street food when I'm in India, and so in order to like coat my stomach with a probiotic layer, she will make me like a salty lassi that's sort of yogurt ice that she blitzes with curry leaves and ginger and chilies. And it'll sort of, I'll like drink two cups of that and then like brave the street food, and she'll like say a prayer at home that I don't come home with diarrhea. I just have these amazing memories of sitting at her table. Like even, you know, when I'm sick, she makes me a packet of instant Maggi noodles, which are sort of the Indian version of instant ramen. And that taste just, the taste reminds me of like being very ill in India and being taken care of. And whenever I'm really ill in New York, I will make myself a packet of Maggi noodles and she kind of doctors them up with some pepper and some chili sauce and things like that. So I feel like those meals shared around that table in Delhi in that house are just, yeah, very sentimental for me.
Out of interest, do you have a sort of strategy when you're going out to eat street food? Because I'm assuming you're there and you're like, I want to try everything.
Does that work? Does the lassi work?
Yes. Oh, no. It doesn't really work. Like, I basically just go to India knowing that I'm going to get sick. Like, I basically, like, account for, like, a day of being sick. I'm going to India in March, and I'm very much, like, I feel like I've eaten a lot of, this is the first time I'm going to India since I've become a food writer. So I'm thinking maybe my stomach has, like, I have a stomach of steel now. I don't know.
Magically happened overnight.
But
makes me, Rick Martinez, who's a contributor to Bon Appetit also, and he is Mexican-American, and he didn't grow up in Mexico, but he like magically can go there. He's like, oh, I can eat anything and nothing happens. Yeah, I'm like, that is not fair, you know?
Yeah,
he like eats every single street food.
The general rule in India is no water products. Like there's a dish called pani puri, which are like little crisps filled with tamarind water and potatoes and chickpeas. And that water you definitely don't want to have.
All my yogi friends told me, I was so nervous about getting sick because we were also traveling. Like my son turned 5 while we were there.
Oh gosh.
And we were moving around a lot. And my husband actually got really violently ill. But all of my yogi friends had been like a million times to they'd all been to Mysore like 8 times, 10 times. I was like, I'm nervous. They're like, what? I'm like, I'm afraid I'm going to, you know, just get sick from the food. And everyone told me to eat vegetarian, strictly vegetarian. And also to be careful of like chutneys and stuff on the street could have like be thinned with water. And I ate vegetarian and I was 100% fine. So was my son and my husband. The thing that did him, it was this a chicken tikka that like I almost took a bite of one night at dinner. He was like, here, try it. And I was like, okay, but I wasn't going to eat meat while I was here. And it was like halfway to my mouth. And I was like, you know what? I just don't feel like it. And the next day he was like, it was wow.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I eat mostly vegetarian. I'm in New York when I'm in India and it doesn't seem to help. My brother-in-law, David, who lived in India for 3 months and is not Indian, he told me this insane story about how he couldn't say no to a street vendor. He accidentally ate 30 pani puris, which are like, and like, that is like, I was just like, when I heard that, I was like, were you a large volume of like unclean water? and nothing happened.
Wow.
It was like this miracle.
It's so interesting because when I'm in Turkey, I never drink the tap water because my poor little English raised stomach will just, you know, terrible things happen. My dad hasn't lived in Turkey in like 45 years and he'll just pour himself a glass of water from the tap and gulp it down and he's fine. Absolutely fine.
Yeah, it's so strange. And the funny thing is, like, my sister and I are the least, we'll eat whatever. But my parents, when they go to India, they won't eat or drink anything. And I'm like, grew up here.
Oh, I'm interested to know then, if you are going to India for the first time as a food writer, do you think you're going to experience it differently?
So I'm going to report a story. So it's the first time I'm going to India sort of as a reporter. So I think that will be interesting in that, like, from a purely practical standpoint, when I go to India, I feel obligated to go to all these parts of India, see my cousins, but I logistically can tell them that I'm here in a strictly journalistic capacity and I can't like travel to Pune to go see them or go to Bombay. Like, I have to stay in Delhi. It's a Delhi story. So I guess I'm excited for the first time in my life to experience Delhi as a tourist.
Mm. Speaking of visiting somewhere as a tourist, I'm curious, because we talk about like what makes a great souvenir and food is usually like last on the list. It is like really hard to buy for somebody else and it's really hard to travel with. Do you guys souvenir shop for like food items when you're traveling?
Oh, yes. Definitely do. That's one of my favorite things to do is
like,
go
tell
to a supermarket.
I'm
like the one who's like, let's just duck into this suit. And my husband's like, this looks like a basic supermarket. I'm like, yeah, but they have different stuff. It's just totally different. I even do that when I'm in the States. Like, I was in Colorado a few years ago for a story and went into, you know, the equivalent of like the Stop and Shop. And I was totally blown away. It was like they had Jaggery in the baking aisle and they had the fresh chili assortment in the thing. And I was like, we think we have it all here in New York. We have like,
we don't.
And I was like, this is living. But I think it's just like the combination of the packaging. I love looking at the prices. And then there's like just different stuff. I'm like, ooh, their mayonnaise is different. Mm-hmm. And this is different. Like, it doesn't even matter. The cereal, it doesn't even matter. I just walk around the stores like fascinated. So it's fun when we're wherever we are, like different kinds of chips and snacks and stuff like that. It's more and more rare now, but the idea that you would find something that you just absolutely can't get here, right? Which like 15 years ago when you traveled, there wasn't, you know, Amazon didn't have like every single thing you could think of. So you would go somewhere and be like, you actually can't get this anywhere else. You know, it's like the butter that everybody comes back from Paris with, that yuzu butter in their backpack or whatever. But yeah, that's what I'm kind of looking for, a thing I've never seen before.
Yeah, our office goes for candy, which is like the go-to, foreign candy. But
our coworker Molly came back from Portugal with an entire suitcase filled with canned fish.
But that makes sense. Yeah. That's like the thing.
Probably in very beautiful tins.
Yeah,
great.
Well. Yeah. Amazing. Like, you don't even want to open them.
Yeah.
Do you have a go-to, Priya?
So I agree with Carlin that like packaged snacks are a big fascination for me. One of the things I'm most excited about going to India is Lay's Magic Masala chips. Mm. It's a brand of it's a flavor of Lay's chips you can only get in India. You can buy them on Amazon if you pay like $30 in shipping. But like, it's literally like in India, I think it maybe costs like 10 cents for a bag. And these chips are like the greatest potato chips I've ever had in my life. They are coated with like amchur and asafoetida. And I think it's mostly just like, it's like chaat masala plus, and they're just like really tangy and spicy and like, they're just so good. And I can't wait to bring back like a suitcase full of Lay's Magic Masala chips. But like, I'm similar to Carla. When I go anywhere, I always go to the grocery store. My mom and I are fascinated by sort of like just buying random assortments of things. Also, like at grocery stores, things are never like the most you might pay. You're not gonna like, it's not like going to a fancy restaurant. Like,
right.
Sort of the barrier to entry is low. Like, I will pay like $5 for this like strange looking package because I'm just curious and it's fine. I'm not like throwing money away. So yeah, I recently did this hiking trip. Started in France and I went through Italy and Switzerland. It's called the Tour de Mont Blanc. And every little town we went to, the first thing I did was go to the grocery store. And it was just the most exciting time.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah. Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
You were talking about, you know, going somewhere for a couple of weeks and cooking a lot when you were in Montauk. How much do you cook in your Airbnb / rental, because most hotels don't have full kitchens, versus going out to eat?
It really depends on the trip. I'm actually leaving tomorrow for Costa Rica with my family, which we are staying in an Airbnb. So it ends up being probably 2 out of 3 meals a day that we eat at home. Always breakfast, you know, just breakfast is easy. Yeah, about half and half. It's really nice to be in a place and not feel dependent. You know, you just get fatigued from eating out. But then there's the trips that I do for work that,
yeah,
there's, you know, it's like you're eating 2 or 3 dinners. Yeah. So there's no cooking involved. But I am big on the room service in the morning. I get
nice.
2 pots of tea. And then I always bring a Zoji Rushi with me. So I have my heat insulated traveling beverage bottle. I get my 2 pots of tea. Immediately one of them gets poured into the Zoji to stay hot while I drink the first one and stay in bed. So that's.
Wow.
And then the rest of it is either reporting with a chef where you're going to be standing up and talking to somebody about food all day and then eating several meals for dinner. Yeah.
We had a big debate in the office about whether room service was a terrible or a great thing. And it was very divided. People had very strong feelings on it.
It's great for me for that caffeine without having to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. That is the ultimate luxury to me, is to stay in bed and drink the tea and then deal. But I think food is ridiculous. A bowl of berries for $30, skip it.
I once stayed at a hotel where I had to pay $20 for a half grapefruit.
No.
Half a grapefruit.
Must have been really good grapefruit.
It was a perfectly fine grapefruit. The sugar sprinkled over it was a nice touch.
Fancy flourish.
It's small sprinkles of gold.
How do your trips go, Priya?
It sort of depends on where I'm going. We do a lot of national park trips. So in national park towns, those places aren't usually known for their food. So we'll get an Airbnb and we'll cook. In fact, one of the best parts about traveling with my parents and especially my extended family is that there's always a spreadsheet that goes around before we leave for the trip. And on the spreadsheet, it's okay, Sangeeta is bringing the Tetley tea bags and the cardamom pods. Rithu is bringing dal. My mom will pre-mix masalas that she can make 3 different subzis and a dal out of. And then, of course, we will get our paranta lady to make 20 parantas, so we have breakfast taken
so
care
funny.
Of. And this
See,
is
my
just
family
like-
is just. I wish we had an Excel sheet. It's just a family text thread that's or it'll be 35 emails. You know, where I'll say to my husband, did you read the last email? We're spending. And he's like, I stopped reading those emails a long time ago.
It's the back of your. Is the trunk just all coolers?
No, it's just literally just in the suitcase. We just slip in the bhujia, the packaged things. It's really funny. But if it's not that, I try to eat out as many times as I can, because as a food journalist, you know, you're always sort of looking for something that's going to be exciting and new. So, you know, if I'm not in a place that I'm interested in, I'll eat at the Airbnb. But otherwise, and often Carla, I'm reporting, so it's very often 2-3 dinners in a night situation. So, yeah.
I think there is something to be said. I mean, Carla, what you're talking about, your memories of Montauk. I mean, some of my favorite sort of food travel memories are being on vacation somewhere and someone cooking a brilliant meal.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so much tied up with the place and the type of trip. One of mine, favorite memories is having like fresh clams on Fire Island after like me and my friends had gone like clamming with a bucket and like drunk beers and like got our clams and then brought them back and put them on the grill. And I was staying with my family on the Isle of Skye in Scotland, which is incredibly remote. And there's like one pub near where we were staying and we'd been there every night. So then we like cooked a big sort of crab feast. And again, that actually was my favorite meal of the entire trip. But again, if I'm going to be in like Tokyo, I'm not going to be cooking in my Airbnb. Yeah,
right.
That reminds me of, I think one of my favorite food memories of all time was when my family went to China in like, it was like 2001. We were all vegetarians at the time. So the options for us were really limited. And so like, we were starving. We had just gone out to pizza and the pizza wasn't actually pizza. And we were so bummed and we were in our hotel room. And then we're staying on this floor and we like see this Indian family and they kind of like sense that we're really bummed. And this like Indian dad just like beckons us into his hotel room. And my whole family is just like, yeah, okay, we'll go into this like Indian dude's Strangers. Hotel room. And we go into his hotel room. He had somehow like jiggered some sort of setup in his hotel where he was like cooking like a makeshift biryani in his hotel room in Beijing. And my family, like, I thought my dad was going to cry when he saw that biryani. And we were like, we are so hungry. And we just like biryani that he had just brought like in a Ziploc bag and it just reheated for us. And
it was
the greatest thing I'd ever eaten at the time.
What a legend.
Yeah. I know, right? And just like so ballsy just to be like, yeah, come. I feel like I understand what you want. Like, yeah, come into my hotel room. And my dad, like, no questions asked, was like, yes.
I feel like I have the lowbrowest of all favorite family food traditions, which is that my family, we usually take beach vacations so that everyone can just, like, totally disconnect. No Wi-Fi, no nothing. And we get a pack of double stuff Oreos for every single day. There are four of us, mind you, and we eat the whole, like, everyone gets a whole tray, and over the course of the day, I mean, like, this, the fact that we haven't gained, like, 700 pounds from all these vacations, but we're going on a trip to New Zealand, and it's our first, like, active vacation in a really long time, and I'm, like, super bummed that the Oreo diet will not be continuing.
Oh, dear.
I know, it's such a bummer.
I mean, why not? Why can't you just do it?
Yeah, you're exercising. Yeah. You could have more of the Oreo diet.
I will bring that up in our next family email.
Or maybe you'll find they have like other different cool flavors of Oreos.
Yeah, that's true.
Zealand,
that's very
they
likely.
Might have like Tasmanian honey flavored stuffing.
Wow.
Who can like say? Setting the bar high. Yeah. I'm curious just to go back to the exciting news that you guys have, which is that you're both putting out your first cookbooks, right?
Yeah.
In the next 2 months. And I'd love to know just like how you went about pitching your cookbooks and putting them together. I know it's probably been a long journey for both of you and it's exciting that it's about to happen. But yeah, curious how that whole process got started.
It does take a really long time, even just kind of the concept part before the pitch. But basically in a sentence, I wanted my cookbook to be a cookbook that would make you excited to go shopping for food so that all of the framework around cooking would actually inspire a different way to shop for food where you eliminate drudgery, schlepping, you know, dread, and really get back to like the idea that shopping for food is what gets you excited to go home and cook because you have flexibility, you have information, you have knowledge, you have confidence. So that was kind of where I was coming at it from. And then the publishers, of course, are like, okay, but it's not a food shopping book, right? Because those don't sell. And I'm like, no, but, you know, everybody loves to say that like, the first ingredient in a good meal is great ingredients, or the first step in a great recipe is the best ingredients. I'm like, cool. So can we talk about that part a little bit? Because you can say that you can't be a good cook unless you have great ingredients. And people just say that and don't say what would be the next logical step is like, you have to go and get them. You know what I mean? And I feel like people really don't know either what to look for, what to do when something isn't there that you expected, how to start cooking something you've never cooked before. So like a lot of that was exciting and fun for me.
I'm curious, Carla, how did your book come about? Was that something that you like knew that you wanted to do, or were people like, we
need
a Carla book?
No, it was more me being like, I'm going to do this thing. Cause I had a few friends who had done, who had gone for it. And I was like, I can do it too. It was like some combination of competitiveness and ego, you know, of like, I can do that too. Also, even though I have this like perfectly nice life, you know, that, so I just kind of wanted the challenge and felt like I had, you know, I could do it. And I kind of wanted to take on a project like that. And then of course, flash forward, like 7 months later, when your manuscript is due and you have a full-time job. And I was like, why did I think this was a good idea? Like, I had a perfectly nice life like that is now ruined.
Like, books are things that people like take sabbaticals for.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I was like, no, it's cool. I get it done. And I did, but it, you know, and I'm happy. But at the time I was like, what the heck? Like, it's like having a kid. You're like, seems like a great idea. And then you do it. And then you have an infant and you're like, why did I do this? So, and then you get over it. But
yeah. Priya, what was the moment, you know, when you thought, oh, I've been writing about these sort of similar themes for a while, maybe this is a book?
So my book was not my idea. I was working at a food magazine called Lucky Peach, and we were producing a book about vegetables called Power Vegetables. And the editor emailed out like a list of recipes that he was like, this is the final list of recipes. And I sent like a very sassy email back being like, there are no Indian recipes in this vegetable cookbook. Like, that can't be. Like, you need Indian recipes. So he just responded and was like, okay, send me some. So I emailed my mom and was like, okay, can you send me these 5 recipes and I need them tomorrow. My mother is like has a full-time job. She's very busy. She stayed up all night. wrote these recipes for me. Sent them back. I forwarded them to our recipe developer. And like a week later, our recipe developer comes up to my desk and I'm really worried she's going to let me down. And she's like, has your mom ever written a recipe before? And I'm like, no, she's never written a recipe before. And she was like, these recipes were written nearly perfectly and they were all great. Like, we're putting all of them in the book.
Oh my God.
And I was like, wait, excuse me? It was this shock to me. I mean, I guess my mother is a trained software programmer, so maybe there's a connection between coding and recipe writing.
Sure.
But I was just, I was shocked. My mom was shocked. And then the editor of our cookbook, this woman named Rika Alanik, just fell in love with my mom's recipes. And after I left Lucky Peach, she had coffee with me and was like, I want a book just of your mom's recipes. Also, like, my mom says sort of like, I talk about her a lot because I really look up to her and respect her. She's sort of this badass software engineer who also dresses really elegantly and throws amazing parties and sort of grew up traveling around the world for her job, which was she worked in the airline industry and sort of was this amazing role model and kind of leaning in before I guess it was cool to lean in. And I guess she was like, I want a book that is not only sort of these Indian American sort of hybrid recipes, but sort of tells a modern mother-daughter narrative, which is different than the one that I feel like this sort of Gilmore Girls style, like your mom is your best friend. She's like home waiting for you, whatever. And also a book that sort of encapsulates like, what does the modern American family look like? It's not all white people living here. And just sort of the wonderful ways that when immigrants come to this country, they sort of take the food of their home and combine it with the food they found here. And so a book proposal was born. And yeah, I mean, I was shocked that people were interested in it, to be honest. Like, my mom's food is never something that I ever imagined that I would write about. It was just the food that I grew up eating. It was like sort of delicious but unremarkable. But then I started explaining things to people and people were like, oh my God, that like blows my mind. Like the concept that I'm doing this thing with Bon Appetit. And one of the concepts is this idea of a chonk, which is like tempering spices in oil. And I remember like telling this to my cookbook photographer and she was like, chonk? How amazing. And my mom was like, I mean, literally I do it every night. This is unremarkable to me. but I like sort of said, I was like, yeah, you can put it on like noodles or steak or nachos. And someone was like, chonk on nachos. It's been kind of cool sort of seeing, I mean, it's indicative of the fact that a lot of these techniques are not written about enough or as much as they should be, but it's been a really cool journey. And my mom wrote 100 recipes for the book. My dad did all the dishes. He did all the grocery shopping for the photo shoot. It was really a family effort. I'm really proud of that.
And so I'd love to know, you both have your first cookbooks coming out. Obviously, you have both turned to cookbooks for advice over the years. What are some of your favorite female-written cookbooks?
I've written about this. I think I wrote about it on Healthy-ish. Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone by Deborah Madison was probably the first cookbook that I really felt like was encyclopedic. And she had a method for every single thing. And some were simple and some were more complex. But the amount of information in that book, there were like very few photographs. And it was every vegetable, grains, spices, how to shop the farmer's market. I just really learned so much from cooking and reading through that book. And another book here that I keep at the office and I refer to a lot for both ideas and information is Uncommon Fruits and Vegetables by Elizabeth Schneider. And it also reminds me of like why books exist, because the people who write them, I'm not including myself in this, are scholars who like are recording information that will be true for decades and decades and decades, which is as we turn more to digital sources and for research and for, you know, I just watch my son researching papers and I'm like, you know, Wikipedia is like not a good source of information. And just that idea that like a thing that it is just what well reported and researched all the way back and historical and like really she's amazing. Yeah, so those two mean a lot to me.
An Invitation to Indian Cooking, my mother Joffrey, is one that I will find myself constantly referring back to. Just her encyclopedic knowledge of Indian food and regional Indian cooking is amazing to me. Same with Tharla Dalal, who's another. She was sort of the like Julia Child of Indian cookbooks and was one of the first people to sort of codify Indian cooking. Her books are just like very wonderful and playful and aren't sort of trying too much to be a thing. Like, in fact, they're like actively ugly, but I just love that about them. These sort of like really kitschy books that existed in like the 80s and 90s. And then a book that like really taught me to cook was this book, Small Victories by Julia Tertian. Julia Tertian, I think, just has like one of the best cooking voices. Like you can read her head notes and follow along and feel like she's actually there in the kitchen teaching you things. Like there are just things I never learned how to make, like, you know, meatballs. And she teaches you how to make those and makes you feel really proud of what you're making. So, yeah, that book really opened up a lot of doors for me.
Amazing. Well, we will link pre-orders for both of your cookbooks in the post. So look in the show description for the show notes and you will find all of that information there. If people want to keep up with you guys, I know that you are both regularly on the Bon Appetit YouTube channel, but where can people find you elsewhere on the internet, Carla?
On Instagram at Lolly Music, L-A-L-L-I Music.
And Priya?
And Carla also is hilarious on Twitter, too.
Oh, I'm a great very Twitter. Intermittent Twitterer.
But like when she tweets, they like land with them. They land.
You have to wait for them to percolate, you know? I'm going with like, some people are in there with like volume. Yeah. I'm going the total opposite.
It's amazing. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at PK Gourmet, G-O-U-R-M-E-T.
I'm at Oh Hey There Mayor.
And I'm at Lale Hannah. And if you happen to be in Austin on March 11th, we will be doing a live podcast at Holy Roller in Austin at 11 a.m. And you can find links to Eventbrite to RSVP on our website.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.